104.3 and 104.7 KHUM Cut in Eureka, Arcata, and Translator K282 AD in Ferndale. That's a long ID, don't you think?
Yes, but well worth it. We didn't have it back in my radio days. Radio wasn't on the internet then.
How did you like being on K-Mud?
It was one of the great experiences of my life, and I'm not even exaggerating slightly. Not just because it's fun being on the back. I mean, when I was a little kid, I used to pretend to be on the radio. And so there's that, just feeling like, hey, I'm on the radio, everybody. People are listening to me, even if they weren't. what was really great, I wrote about it in my first book, Spy Rock Memories, which was about living up in the mountains here, not so far from here. It was learning about the sense of community and how a radio station or a newspaper, just some kind of media, a media institution can create a sense of community where there was none before. When I first moved to the mountains, there was basically nothing connecting all of these people living in this far-flung region. I mean, there was my nearest neighbor was a mile away, and up in my little canyon, there was maybe 50, 100 people. And for that reason, I started my own little magazine. Well, first a newsletter, then a magazine called Lookout, and created a little controversy. But when K-Mud started in Garberville, it was like suddenly thousands of people from all northern Mendocino and southern Humboldt were all connected. And the longer the station went on and the more it grew, I mean, it just sort of drew people in. You know, all of a sudden everybody was just sort of knew something. Well, they said, hey, it's like seeing yourself in the collective mirror of consciousness and saying, hey, I'm part of something. I'm not just this guy or lady or family up in the backwoods on the side of a mountain all by ourselves. We're part of a whole community. And so that was what was so great about being on K-Mud. And the other thing that was so great is I learning to get along, because a lot of my whole shtick back in those days was like trashing everybody else's music and clothes and culture that I was not part of, and including especially the prevailing music of the day, which was basically the Grateful Dead and reggae. And after being on K-Mud a while, I learned to say, hey, next up after me is the reggae show, and it's going to be great. Stay tuned in. And not just be like kind of doing my job as a DJ, but I really meant it, because they might have hated punk rock once, and they might still not particularly like to listen to it, but they would be like, hey, thanks for that great punk rock show. And we all worked together. You know, individually, none of us could have made a station, but all the different types of shows and all the different types of attitudes by pulling together could make a really awesome radio station, which now like has grown beyond, I think, any of our wildest dreams. And you know, I don't want to sound corny. That's kind of America right there. That's what the melting pot, the all pulling together and building something. That's what I liked about K-Mud.
It's also community and radio. One thing that I love about radio is it does that. It brings a community together. That's why I traveled across the country to this radio station here, because KM also values bringing the community together.
No doubt it does. We were beyond the reach of the K-Hum signal, if it was even on the air back then.
Yeah, it started in 96.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It was about the time that I was leaving.
It also demonstrates in your book how different this area is than anywhere else, because you mentioned a show that you put together in Mendocino County where it was like a punk rock show with Green Day and all that. Since a lot of the bands were unknown, a lot of the people went down to the Grateful Dead. Jerry Garcia show. And anywhere else in the country, you wouldn't really see that.
That was actually in southern Humboldt, in Garberville. It's like on southern Humboldt and northern Mendocino are kind of the same bioregion. Up here in northern Humboldt, it's really a whole different world. Tweeted out a picture of Ferndale as I was coming into town, you know, and it's just, it's like incredibly beautiful, but it's a different type of beauty than what we had down there, which is very mountainous and kind of severe. And here it's just so gentle, almost kind of a little bit, reminds me a little bit of rural England, in fact. And you know, Ferndale was kind of a magical place. But yeah, that the show you're talking about was in 1989 in the Vets Hall in Garberville. And yeah, I think almost any band on that bill could fill a place today, and Green Day, of course, could fill a Coliseum. But yeah, it was a tough competing with Jerry Garcia at that time, and yet the same kids would have come to see our show the next night if Jerry, or that night if Jerry hadn't been in town.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But it shows how different and how amazing this place is. I love it. Anyway, right now, if you're just tuning in, I have Larry Livermore in here. He's going to be reading from How to Ruin a Record Label. It's your second book. It's a story of Lookout Records today at the works. It's
just to clarify, it could also be read as How to Run a Record Label.
Yeah, because the eyes.
It's a play on words. And yeah, I actually just got a note from somebody that their bookseller was pretty annoyed at having to type up that kind of weird wordplay in order to order it for him. But it's been usually read as How to Ruin, and the record label did ultimately have a sad ending.
But
yeah, anyway, I'll be talking about it and reading from it at the works tonight, I think at 6 p.m. in lovely Old Town Eureka.
And asking questions, it's free, all ages, so people should come out.
It's definitely all ages, and questions are encouraged. That's always my favorite part of these events is answering questions.
So, homework, come up with questions for Larry today. But you say that you have a song that you ended up writing about Ferndale.
I love this area so much. I have songs that I've written and recorded about Arcata, Eureka, and Ferndale. And Ferndale, I think it may be unique. I've not ever heard another song about Ferndale. And this is only a demo, but it's a reasonably well-recorded demo. So I'd be honored to present it, provided it works, coming off of my phone here.
Well, we tested it out.
Let's give it a go. No? Is it working?
Yeah, it's working. That was the Potato Men with Toy Town on KHUM. So that was your second band after the
that
Lookouts.
That was the Potato Men, and it's one of my favorite songs we ever wrote, but it never got released because of a little bit of difficulty. The drummer at that time was losing interest in the band and kind of did a slapdash performance, so we got somebody else to dub his parts in, and he found out and said that we couldn't release it like that, so we substituted a Smiths cover, and which is a good song, but it was we shouldn't have been doing that. And then we had a new lineup that recorded it as a demo a couple years later, but it was never released. It was actually, as I was telling you off mic, written from, I used to sort of hang out sometimes here, especially I was especially fond of hanging out in the graveyard up the side of the hill and looking down at the town. And it's written from the point of view of a young kid that grew up in Ferndale, where everything was so beautiful and precious and old, and including most of the people. And he just felt just so alienated by, feeling like he was living in the 19th century instead of his own time, and just nothing to connect to, and didn't know how to, wanted to get away, but didn't know how to.
Wow. It was a quite fabulous song.
Why, thank you so much.
Very much. Well, we're going to go ahead and have to take a quick break, play some messages from some of our sponsors, and then you want to hang around and play some more music and
talk
more about
your
book? Okay, sweet. And that's Larry Livermore. He's going to be at the Works today at 6, talking about how to run or ruin a record label, which is out now, and it's an awesome book. It's an awesome book.
Century. Everything was new to you and me. In the home of the brave and fancy free, where you can be all you can be. Came as no surprise when we opened up our eyes. Had a chance to see the whole world for a small thing. It was so easy. In the 20th century. Of chivalry, every gentleman and fine lady had a place in the course of history. In between well-off and poverty, and the welfare state keeps on eating up your plate. Only hope for me is to win the lottery. No chance of that in the 21st century. Century. That's where I really want to be. In the home of the me mentality. Where you can be all you can be. In the army. Came as no surprise when we opened up our eyes. Had a chance to see the whole world for a small fee. Wasn't so young then, and I'm even older now. Hanging with the kids in the same.
That was the Cutters with Back in the 20th Century. I was just telling Larry that Mike Wilson was in that band.
I've met this guy more than once and hung out with him, and I don't think he... I mean, no, he never told me. Well, maybe he said he was in a band once, but everybody was in a band once. But
He was the guitarist in that one.
Cool. No, he wasn't bragging about it anyway. That's a pretty good sounding band.
Yeah, it sucks that they aren't around anymore.
It kind of does. It sounds like I'm kind of surprised that they didn't get more widely heard. They were very catchy, and the vocal harmonies especially were good. If I were still in the music business, it's the kind of band I would definitely talk to.
Sweet. Awesome. Well,
I was always especially interested in finding bands that reflected the Humboldt and Mendocino kind of ethos and aesthetic. And we didn't have a lot of bands in Mendocino, although you may have heard of AFI.
Is AFI from Mendocino?
The nucleus of it. Yeah, Davey grew up in Ukiah.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
He's singing with No Doubt now, apparently.
Yes, so we were. I actually, although we were moving in the same circles for a number of years, I actually never met him until just a couple of years ago. And really, really nice guy, wonderful guy.
Did you talk about Mendocino?
Oh yeah, we talked about all sorts of things, and that was part of it. His mom still lives down there and works in the bookshop in Mendocino County. And
that's really neat.
She did a really great interview. She's sort of, I wouldn't want to call her a hippie. She's not a hippie at all, but she's certainly of that generation. And the interview that she did was really good on the whole culture clash. How, like, what do sort of 60s generation moms do with like punk rock kids, and how she dealt with him growing up and finding his way in the world.
Where was that interview published? That sounds
darn if
good.
I can. I think it was published more than one place, but I believe I became aware of it through the Anderson Valley Advertiser, which is a radical, really awesome newspaper down in Boonville in Mendocino County. They call themselves, and I think with some justification, America's last newspaper. It's kind of like you referred to KHUM as the last freeform radio station in America.
Commercial.
Last commercial freeform radio station, yeah. The Anderson Valley Advertiser is pretty much the equivalent in terms of newspapers. They represent an American tradition that goes back to at least the 18th or 19th century, where one really strong editor or publisher just pretty much creates something that reflects his or her, but unfortunately in the past mostly his, character and views, and prints whatever they feel like. And some it's an institution that I was proud to be part of. Bruce Anderson, it's just a weird coincidence, he moved to the Anderson Valley, which has nothing to do with his family, but he's named Anderson. He bought the local newspaper, which was a typical Republican conservative small town paper at the time in the 80s, and turned it into this radical, I mean, you know, it's the kind of newspaper where they argue whether Bernie Sanders is socialist or leftist enough, and usually he's not. But at the same time, they cover all of the small town news, the bake sales and the lost dogs. You know, they manage to embrace it all, and it's read all over the country, not by a huge number of people, but by a lot of connoisseurs of really great journalism.
And you were involved with it for a while?
I was involved in several ways. For one thing, well, now it's doing pretty well, but back then it was a shoestring operation, and Bruce, the editor-publisher, used to just lift any of my articles from the Lookout magazine about North County and just print them. I mean, I was honored to have them printed, but he didn't bother asking permission, which is fine. And then I started submitting articles directly to the paper, and then when he got put in jail for punching the superintendent of schools in a debate over funding, this was when Mendocino County in the 80s, I was the guest editor for a while he was in jail, which was also a great honor.
Well, you were involved with everything at one point.
Well, that's part of learning to be in a community. That's again, a lot. I talk about that a lot in my first book, Spy Rock Memories, because when I first came there, I was the weird punk rock guy who everybody kind of was either suspicious of or hated. And I kind of was like, oh, these bunch of backwards hicks and stuff. That I returned the favor. And
you just landed there after you left Detroit, right?
No. I bounced all over the place, but I'd been in the San Francisco Bay Area for quite a long time when I got kind of really burnt out on, well, the city and everything. And I had this kind of epiphany where I'm going to go off into the wilderness and start my own civilization. And, somebody probably should have signed this up for a sitcom, or they didn't have reality shows yet back then. It turned up here in the country in my punk rock clothes and kind of a couple of garden tools like you'd use in the suburbs, and thinking I'm going to just like move into this wilderness where it's like 10 miles from the nearest paved road. And
did you know anything about gardening, or?
I didn't know anything about anything. I mean, within 3 weeks of arriving here, I was snowed in for a month and a half with 5 feet of snow at the top of this mountain.
Did you have any food?
Yeah, just about enough. I got through. And the house almost caved in, too, because in the middle of the blizzard, I had to get up on top of the roof, and because I realized none of the doors would open anymore. And I remembered I'd heard once about all these houses back east in New England collapsing under the weight of snow. And I was like, oh, no. And so I was up there, if something like that had happened, or if, I was digging up firewood and... For about 2 weeks, it was just barely staying alive, and if anything had gone wrong, I would have been dead. But this is the ironic thing, is when I first discovered this particular mountain wilderness, I was like, I'm so jaded with the city and all this phony, just all we ever do is dress up and go to parties and stuff. I want something real, and... Once I was up on the mountain just before I moved up there, and it was a very cold late winter night with snow everywhere, and I was like, oh my God, somebody could die up here if they didn't know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was true. I very nearly did a few times.
Wow, well, you got lucky. And you wrote about that in your first book, Spy Rock?
I did, Spy Rock Memories.
I need to read that. The How to Run / Ruin a Record Label was the first book I ever read that you wrote. And, I guess it's your second one, so I'm doing pretty good. But I really liked it, and your writing style is really easy to read. And
well, thank you. I've been writing off and on most of my life, and in fact, starting the Lookout magazine up on the mountain, which was actually four sheets of paper Xerox down at the feed store in Willits, which was the only place in the North County that had a Xerox machine at that time. In fact, I had to collate it. I was stacking up the different pages on the bags of manure. And people never got tired of saying, well, that's a pretty fitting start for that magazine.
That's funny.
But it was learning that I could reach a lot of people and actually become part of the civic discourse. I mean, some issues, environmental issues and political issues came up in our local village, Laytonville, at that time. And with fairly quickly, I became part of that civic dialogue and, almost as much as the local established newspaper. And that was what really taught me that, hey, if I want to put music out, I could do that too. It's not exactly the same, but it's essentially the same principle. If you got something to say and you find the technology to make it possible, usually on the cheap because, people like we were didn't have a lot of money to play with, but we had ideas. Yeah.
It just seems like you just took one step at a time, and it just kind of happened on its own, which is pretty cool.
It just grew.
One thing that the book shed light on for me that I didn't know much about, I remember whenever all that happened with the Lookout Records and Operation Ivy and Green Day pulling their records out, and I remember whenever that happened and how crazy that was, and I didn't understand everything that led up to it.
Oh, well... It was a tragic time. That actually happened about 8 years after I left. The book, this book that we're talking about, How to Ruin Run.
it's kind of hard to...
Yeah, it is. It's annoying. a pain. I'm sorry to all librarians who have to deal with it. But, that's kind of the dramatic climax of the book when I get into what happened then. I began to run into a lot of conflict with, you know, when the label grew so big. I mean, it literally went from a few thousand dollars worth of 7-inch records to $10 million a year of just multimedia empire. And although I was clever enough to get the thing going and keep it running pretty well, I was not kind of happy with the direction it went. It got too big. There was a lot of pressure to become more commercial and more corporate. And plus, I had my own personal demons going on at the time. So in 1997, it all came to a head. There was a bit of a showdown between myself and one of the people that had come to work for me and who I'd made a partner. And I walked away. I just said, well, fine, here, you have the record label. It was, you know.
He was 24.
He was 24 years old, but he was a smart 24. He was from Humboldt also. He's from Southern Humboldt.
He's the one who you did the radio show with, isn't he?
Yes. I met him in Arcata. The first time we played, we brought Operation Ivy and Crim Shrine and Isocracy up to the depot in Arcata and played a show. And just as we were leaving, this little kid came running across. Hey, wait. And I thought he was just telling us we'd forgotten something. But he was like, just wanted to meet us. And he was... 14, I think, just short of turning 15, and he had his own show on KMOD, which was a pretty new station at that time. And he said, can you bring some records and we can play them on my punk rock show at KMOD, which, you know, the idea of any punk rock show in Southern Humboldt at that time seemed like really pretty far-fetched. So I came by to be a guest and end up becoming the co-host, and he in turn came to work for me for the next, quite a few years and became a partner in the label. But as he got into his 20s, he kind of, his ideas of how to run the label changed a lot, and we increasingly butted heads. And but I thought we shared essentially the same values, and so even if he might have signed different bands and so on, I was sure he would continue running the record label essentially the same way I had. So I said, fine, you take the label, I am going to go live in England and be in a band and write books and stuff, and that was that. If I ever wrote a single life story, I mean, it's a whole history of dumb decisions and a handful of smart ones, but this was one of the dumber ones that I made, and probably pretty irresponsible too. But I was like, oh well, you know, time to do something new, and kind of just walked away from this multi-million-dollar company and says, I don't need it anymore. I don't want it anymore. And unfortunately, from that point, it did go into decline. And at some point, and for reasons, a couple of us old-timers were just talking about it the other night. For some reason, the new people stopped paying the bands. I have no idea why. And it's the first it's the principle, it's the very most fundamental principle. You put aside enough money to pay your bands. I mean, you're there to serve them and to...
Well, it seems like they got in a sticky situation with having to buy like another, like you mentioned, Ben Weasel's
Well, that was one issue, and that was quite a bit of money. But, I mean, seriously, there was a lot of money to play with, probably too much. And that wasn't the only unfortunate decision. There was a difference in philosophy, and that's probably why we butted heads as much as anything, which is they were of the opinion that you could make any band that you liked popular if you spend enough money promoting them. And I was of the opinion that, you know, sometimes bands I liked would become popular, but some bands I liked, and they might even be really great, important bands, but probably only a few people are going to like them. The difference is, you know, like a couple of Humboldt County bands, Brent's TV from Arcata and Nuisance from Fortuna. I loved them, and they were absolutely precious sort of exemplars of the culture and the time that they came from. And yet I knew that probably they're not going to sell a lot of records in New York City or most other places in the country. So we pressed a few thousand records and did it on the cheap and got it out there for the ones that wanted. And a lot of people treasure those records. But if I had taken the attitude of let's take out an ad in Rolling Stone and make a video and, you know, and broadcast them from outer space and then everybody will love them, you know, I would have gone broke pretty fast too. I think that's probably the biggest thing that went wrong. This idea that, well, there was this thing of we got to start acting like a real record label, a professional record label. I was like, why? We, you know, the first 2 years it was run from a solar powered cabin in the mountains, 10 miles from the nearest telephone.
I know, and you all had the iconic address. What was it?
P.O. Box 1000, Laytonville, California, 95454. And after that, for another 5 years, from this just ridiculously, well, in British language, it would be called a grotty bedsit. It was a one room where I lived. It was about half the size of this studio. I'm sorry your listeners can't see, but this studio is not, it's luxurious, but not huge. And luxurious in a sort of funky, humble way.
Yeah. When we have a band in here, it's still pretty packed, but there's enough room for everybody.
Yeah, but we ran it, and during that time, when, you know, these three complete amateurs, well, one, then two, then three complete amateurs went from our initial investment of $4,000 to many millions of dollars. Why would we need to emulate the big record companies that were constantly going out of business? Mm-hmm. And yet that was the constant pressure. We need to be more professional. And I like being an amateur.
But the music industry also changed so much at that time, too, with the internet. And
people often ask that question. To be honest, at the time I left, the internet had not made huge inroads into sales yet. It was just barely beginning to. We did use the internet a lot. We had a website fairly early on. But I don't think we had even started selling things on the internet yet. Our big drama during my time at Lookout was, should we do CDs or not? Because that was the exciting new medium that corporate companies used and punks didn't.
Yeah, I know. Maximum Rock and Roll wouldn't even write about
it was
stuff
like,
on CDs, right?
We made our first CD, I think, in 1990. For the first couple of years, we were like, no, that's... because they sold them for so much more money than records and tapes at that time. But by 1990, we said we got to at least try it, and quickly found out that we sold way, way more of those than anything else. That's what people wanted to listen to music on. But it's true, Maximum Rock and Roll wouldn't even acknowledge their existence for another at least five or more years after that.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the crucial decisions where I made the right call. If I hadn't, I remember we did the first Operation Ivy album and first Green Day album only on vinyl and cassette. And in 1991, I was saying, I think we better reissue them on CD because there's probably people that don't have record players or cassette players anymore. And our distributor, all the punks, like, no, everybody already has that record. You know, we've already sold like 2,000 of each. And our distributor says, oh, well, if you really must, okay, make some CDs, but don't make very many. And like, I think she sold 5 or 10,000 of them instantly and was like, get me more. and from then on, that was what it was like. I mean, the whole first year of Operation Ivy was out. They had broken up basically almost the day the record came out, so they never played a show with the record out. And we sold 2,000 records that year, vinyl and cassette combined. We were really excited. This is like one of our biggest successes so far. In 1995, when everything was at its heyday, we sold 2,000 every week of that band, and they'd been broken up for 6 years and hadn't done a thing. That was kind of at the heart of my whole idea of why if something is good, you don't need to spend a bunch of money promoting it. We never promoted Operation Ivy or Green Day at all, apart from $100 on ads in Flipside and Maximum Rock and Roll. That was it.
And the band has to do their own footwork, too.
Well, Green Day did do that. They toured incessantly all over the country and in Europe, doing it all their own way, on their own. For, I mean, people like to sneer at them. Oh, they just came out of nowhere and, you know, had all this marketing and stuff, you know. Yeah, once they signed to Warner Brothers, they got a lot of marketing. Not even a lot, but some. Up until that time, for the first 7 years, or 6 years rather, they did it all themselves. And these were kids. I mean, when Green Day made their first record, they were 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that, the whole first album, which is now like at least platinum, if not more so, I mean, that was written when they were 16 and 17.
And it's an amazing album and still holds up today.
Yeah, it still holds up.
Well, I need to take another break real quick, and then you want to talk about talk a little bit more, and then maybe we can play something.
I will talk about whatever you want to ask me about, or you can play music. I'm happy with both.
Oh, maybe we can do both. Nice medium right there.
Okay.
Well, come on out and see Larry Livermore. You're going to be reading a bit from How to Run/Ruin a Record Label, the story of Lookout Records, today at 6 p.m. at The Works. It's free and all ages. You have it tuned to KHUM.
Now that community.
You're listening to KHUM. Right now, I'm Valeria Livermore in here, who's going to be at The Works coming up at 6 p.m. today to read from and answer questions about the new book, How to Run/Ruin a Record Label, the story of Lookout Records, which had a few bands that people might have heard of on there. But anyway, you just asked me if I'd been to Southern Humboldt before, and yeah, I have been there a few times. Do you count Petrolia as Southern Humboldt?
No.
No?
Not even slightly.
I've been to Willits.
Well, that's Northern Mendocino, sort of the beginning of Northern Mendocino.
I've been to Leggett's, which is Mendocino.
That's definitely Northern Mendocino. I was just passing through there yesterday, and I was saying, poor old Leggett. You know, Laytonville, which used to, well, I mean, I got in a lot of trouble in the early days of writing my magazine, Lookout Magazine, because I made a lot of, you know, unkind jokes about Laytonville and its two gas stations and one bar and...
Well, there's beauty to a town like that, too. Well, I mean, there's connections. I love small towns.
I learned that. But aesthetically, actually, my whole journalism career began because there was a handful of old redwood trees right alongside the highway. Not redwood trees. They were Doug firs, but, you know, stately firs. They've been there a long time. And somebody cut them down because they wanted to expand a parking lot. And I said, well, you know, one of the few touches of grace and beauty in so-called downtown Laytonville, and somebody has to destroy it. And boy, did people get really, really mad at me because I said, you know, that town's not much to look at. You know, it could be if they just use a little sense. At this point, I was just sending in letters to the local paper, which at that time was called the Laytonville Ledger. It's now the Mendocino County Observer. It was great for discussion of civic issues, but I mean, I had a whole page of letters denouncing me, and that kind of went on for a few months until they got so many complaints they refused to print my letters anymore, and that's what prompted me to start my own magazine, which ended up being even bigger than the local paper. But That's how I got started, and you know, a little bit of Laytonville bashing. I must say, yeah, I am pretty proud of how Laytonville's come along. I hope they continue to do so. I mean, I hope they don't sprawl out like Willits, where Willits used to be a cute little town just centered around the town, the intersection of Commercial and Highway 101, and just everything was walking distance, and now it's this sprawl for miles in every direction of fast food places and motels. I hope they don't let that happen in Laytonville. But they have sidewalks now and streetlights, which are something we never had back in those those days. And I have mixed feelings about that, just as they've also paved part of Spy Rock Road, which is unimaginable. That was when leaving Highway 101, starting up Spyhawk Road, used to be like kind of coming down out of a smooth jetliner and hitting the ground. And like from then on, it was just like washboard roads for the next 10 miles up the hill and all the way in second gear to my house. And now it's like this smooth pavement. It just seems unnatural. But Leggett sort of has just languished. I mean, a lot of the businesses have closed, and you barely even notice it as you go past. It's kind of, but maybe it's time will come. I used to stop there quite a bit, and there's not as much there as there used to be.
Well, they have the drive-through tree and a few other things.
You know, I have never driven through the drive-through tree. I have walked up to it many a time and seen it very close up, but I've never. Actually, that's not true. When my aunt came from England, I think we drove her through it. She was like, that's a lot of money to drive through a tree.
Yeah, because it costs like $5, $10 or something like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's funny.
I said, like you've got a lot of trees to drive through in England? Not really.
What do they have there? Stonehenge? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, just a bunch of old rocks piled up.
All right. Well, unfortunately, our time has run out. But if you want to come on out and please see Larry Livermore coming up today at the Works in Eureka at 6 p.m., it's going to be a fabulous time.
I hope so. Well, it will be for me. I don't know about the audience.
But you wanted to play a song from The Lookouts.
Yeah, and it's funny. We were just speaking of England because, in fact, I was just west of Stonehenge when I wrote this song in 1987, and I had to pull off the road because of this horrendous storm, and I got this idea of what it was like in ancient times when the Romans invaded England about in the year 65 BC, and what it would have been like for these like sort of essentially native people to see these, you know, people, these legions coming all dressed up in shiny metal and with all these weapons and things, and then I kind of compared it to. Because this was at the time when the government was coming down pretty heavy on Humboldt and Mendocino, too, and I kind of oh, we're like that. So it's a song. It's called The Green Hills of England, but it's also about the green hills of Humboldt and Mendocino and the Emerald Triangle, and that's, yeah, I'm very proud of it. I like it a lot. Thank you.
is The Lookouts with the Green Hills of England. And remember, Larry Livermore, it's going to be on over at The Works today at 6 p.m. in Eureka. It's free, all ages, and going to be reading from new book, How to Ruin / Run a Record Label, The Story of Lookout Records. Coming up, we have Lindsay Battle, KM.